us the reason that we need to get up. You give us the reason that we need to just have a purpose in our daily routines. And God, I just pray that we take advantage and the opportunities that you put before us. And God, as whenever we study, Lord, I pray that we continue just to increase our knowledge, increase our love for you. God, we just thank you and praise you in your son's name. Amen. All righty. If you haven't turned there yet, turn into 1 Kings chapter 7. We are looking through this and trying to understand a little bit of the importance of, and as we study through this and as I read through this, I come to the understanding of there's a lot of information about buildings. And with all the information about buildings, sometimes it gets a little bit, so why are we studying this for? What is the importance of this? Well, set something there in 1 Kings 7 and turn to Hebrews chapter 8. I want to just share a little bit about some scriptures. I love when scriptures help each other, when scriptures continue to, I think, prove each other to be true. But in Hebrews chapter 8, what we find here is, obviously we know Hebrews was written by an individual who was well-versed in the Old Testament, well-versed in the Hebrew ways. And in Hebrews chapter 8, looking at verse 14, Hebrews chapter 8, now let's look at verse 4, and then we'll go down through to another chapter. Verse 4 of chapter 8 says, For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. So what we see in Hebrews 8:4 is, when it talks about a copy and a shadow, Moses is the one who built the tabernacle in the Old Testament. It's a copy and a shadow of what I think heaven is going to be. And we're going to put that forth in a little bit more light as we study through even tonight. Go to chapter 9, verse 23. Again, the same concept. In verse 23 of chapter 9 of Hebrews, therefore it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy place made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into the heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. So they're copies. And so when you're studying through the tabernacle, and you're studying through the temple, and what is yet to come that God is creating yet for us in heaven for eternity, they're all copies and shadows of what it will be like. And notice how each one is a little better and a little bigger. The tabernacle was of one size and it was of cloth, had a holy of holies in it. But now Solomon's temple, he doubled the size of the tabernacle. And of course, as we studied through last week, at the end of chapter 6, we realized that the cost of this temple in today's figures would be over $200 to $300 billion for this temple. I mean, he held no expense back in building this temple for God. And so realizing all those things, can you imagine what the next one's going to look like? What the next temple is going to be that God is going to create. And on Wednesdays, we were studying that as we've gone through the text to see that that was one of the things that the two witnesses came down and they were martyred and they rose back up and they were witnesses of God, and God built the temple. And he built it on the same place that Solomon has built the temple, but this time God's going to be ruling and reigning in the temple. And so putting scriptures together is a phenomenal thing. And studying all of the scriptures, the whole counsel of God, even though when I read through the genealogies, I'm like, really? But anyway, they're important because they're in the Bible. They're just hard to study through and read through. But so give you a little incentive as we go through these buildings and some of the areas and some of the things that we find tonight. As Solomon continued to build and continued to do things, there was a purpose in it. And in that purpose, Solomon just loved to build. And I was listening to a gentleman talk about this, and it was kind of interesting. I never heard this before, but they call it the Solomon Complex, literally today. And they give that title to someone who just hasn't had enough. Always building. That one didn't work, so you build another one. That one did, and you're constantly creating, constantly building, constantly. And it's a literal term, Solomon's complex. Solomon had a complex, his own. He was Solomon. He had the Solomon complex. And in that whole concept, what it was is because Solomon built. If you do a history and a study, he built cities. He built the Solomon Poles. I don't know if you guys were able to go up to the Poles of Solomon when you guys were up there. Gary, he built the poles of Solomon, and then the irrigation went down, the water went down in Jerusalem after these poles collected the water, and they're still today. You can visit them. So we got to understand, and the reason I'm saying all that is because when you get into the next chapter 7, of course, chapter 6 says that basically the very last verse of chapter 6, and in the 11th year in the month of Bull, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all the details according to the plans. So he was 7 years in building it. The temple is done. Okay, Solomon, sit back and relax. No. Remember, he's got that complex. He's got to continue to build. And so we get into chapter 7, verse 1. And again, just a reminder that he had 183,000 workers around the clock. There were shifts of men that were working for 7 years straight, 183. So I say that because when you get into verse 1, but Solomon took 13 years to build his own house, so he finished all his house. Now, again, many think, well, that's because he really went all out on his place instead of the temple. He went out all on his place for sure, but I think his top priority was getting the house of God built and getting it done quickly. Because unfortunately, the house where God resided in was a whole lot more important in his day than it is our day today. The building which God resides in is what we call our sanctuary, what we're in today. This is a church. This is where we come, the presence of God, Deus Adir, Latin for God is present. It's on our wall. It's what we believe. We know that he is here. And so back then, it was a whole lot more priority to get it done and to be there and to be a part of it. Much more so than it is today. So he put much more manpower into building the temple. He put much more priority in building the temple. And so not everybody, I don't think it's dogmatic for us to say that he spent 13 years because he was building his bigger and better. I think some of the reasons it could be one is, remember the detailed plans that God gave David? David gave Bathsheba. Bathsheba gave to Solomon. We looked at that in the beginning of chapters. And so the detailed plans to build. Now, I know some of you guys like to mess around in the shop. You know, you like to build things. And how much time does it take you when you have to create the plans as you build? Or you have a set blueprint and you just build what's there? Although, if you're like me, most of the times you go a little off grid anyway and you change the blueprints and you build it how you need to. But the time frame, and I don't think Solomon had detailed plans on how he was going to build his house or how he was going to build the cities and how he was going to build everything he was doing. So that could come into play on the difference or the amount of years. Also, again, the workforce. I'm not thinking he still had 183,000 men to build his house. No doubt there was a lot, but was it the same level of intensity with shifts 24 hours a day building and working on the house? So that's a possibility in some of the time frame also. Then the third thing is distractions. Solomon's distractions were great. Again, because he was building so much at the same time. It's amazing. I challenge you to do a study on all the things that Solomon built. In fact, go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Set a finger there in 1 Kings and Ecclesiastes 2. Solomon himself, of course, we know that Solomon wrote Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and he wrote Ecclesiastes. And these books are of wisdom, are of quotes. And he wrote this one, Ecclesiastes, towards the latter part of his life, towards the end of his life. And he was reflecting back on all the things that he had accomplished. And in chapter 2, starting in verse 4, I made my works great. I built myself houses, planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had a greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver, gold, and the special treasures of the kings and of the princes. I acquired male and female singers with the delights of the sons of men and the musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Solomon had a problem. He just loved to build and to create and to keep going and bigger and better and building. And you could almost see that in the three things that he wasn't allowed to acquire. We saw that back in Deuteronomy. Before they ever had a thought of a king, God warned them, don't let your king have a lot of wives, a lot of military, and a lot of money. But I think it was within Solomon. He had to have the bigger the better. He had to have a lot of stuff. And so even in the wrong areas, he was somebody who built. He continued to establish things. So the reason for the 13 years, it can be explained a little differently than just the fact he just put more time and effort into money and wanted his bigger and better than the temple of God. A lot of things going on, a lot of distractions. And again, he just simply never finished. He finished the projects, but he was never content in what he had. And that's an amazing life lesson from Solomon that we can learn tonight. Are you content with what you have? Or do you want more? Do you want something else? Do you want, in today's day and age, a different color? I don't like my car no more because it's not the right color. Well, sorrow, you know. Go into debt because you have like blue instead of white. I don't know. But we have all these things in our lives that we realize that, and I can see it very, very clearly in America, we are not content people. We are not content. And we may have a better handle on it than most, but we still go to the store every week. We still go buy things every week. And so when one thing's wears out, you know, we don't baby it, fix it. We don't run the wheels off of it. We trade it in and get a new one. Or we'll go get something new, something different. And so as we look at this, we can't fault Solomon too much for never being content, because I think we live in a world of discontentment. And we always want to get something else, something newer. So we need to be careful with that, or you're going to end up with the Solomon complex. You're going to continue to go and continue to build and continue to want and continue to move in the direction that the world will gladly pave the way for you. But in all of that process, as Solomon looked back in Ecclesiastes 2, he looked back at that and said, all my toil, all my time, all my money was nothing. Just vanity of vanities. And I honestly think if we look back over some of the things we've involved our lives in, some of the things, the hours we worked, the money, the things we acquired, all those things, we could say the same. A lot of the things we look back to and we can see, you know what, that really wasn't important. I just wanted it. And so living in the land of the blessing, just like the nation of Israel was told, don't forget your God in the land of promise. We have forgotten our God in the land of blessing. We can get what we want whenever we want it. Doesn't matter. And if you don't have the money, better yet, charge it so that everybody else makes money on you. That's exactly the world we live in. If you pay cash for everything, you have no good credit. None. If you pay with card and you're a little bit in debt over your eyeballs, they love you. Because they can't make money on somebody who pays their bills on time. They would rather give you loans and give you cards to people who can't pay it off because they make the money off of them. Listen, that just, isn't that messed up? I want you to not do it right so that I can make money on you. That doesn't even sound right. And yet that's what our world's all about. So we live in this area. So Solomon, he understood it. He realized it. And actually, he realized at the end of his life how much foolish all of that was. So he built his house. He finished it. But we're going to also see, when you go down through this chapter, you're going to see Solomon's house. And then you're going to see he also built. It's three or four times in his chapter. And it's going to explain the Solomon complex he has. He continued to build. So the next chapter, verse 2, says he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now, it wasn't a summer getaway. It wasn't a mansion in Lebanon. It was a home that was made of all the cedar from Lebanon. Now, I don't remember the square footage of all this. You can figure out, remember, a cubic is 18 inches. You guys who like mass, figure out the square. It's 2,000 some odd square feet, whatever it is, probably more than that. He built this home of Lebanon. And the best way I can describe it is it was a massive cedar chest times 10. That's what it was. And as you read, we read down through this, look at verse 2. Its length was 100 cubics, its width 50 cubics, and its height 30 cubics, or three stories, four rows of cedar pillars, cedar beams on the pillars, and it was paneled with cedar above the beams that were on 45 pillars, 15 to a row. There were windows with beveled frames in three rows. Again, three rows be three heights, and windows were opposite windows in the three tiers. Again, shows the three heights. And all the doorways and doorposts had rectangular frames, and windows was opposite the window and the three tiers. So you have this massive cedar chest is what it was. Can you imagine when you walk into that what it would smell like? Wouldn't it be a heaven almost, you know? I mean, any of you have cedar chests at home? You put your old blankets in, you know, you open them up. It's almost like a gone-by thing, right? Now we have plastic totes. We go from cedar chest to plastic totes, really. They're more stackable, right? They're easier to throw away. Whatever, I don't know. But we have very few. We do have a cedar chest, and I enjoy it. You open it up, but it's only very thin cedar paneled on the inside. It's not solid cedar. But it smells so good when you open it up, put one of them blankets on. But I can't imagine. This whole place smelled of that cedar. So he built that. That was one of the things he built. And then we go into verse 6. He also made the hall of pillars. Its length was 50 cubics and its width was 30 cubics. And in front of them was a portico with pillars and a canopy in front of them. Then he made a hall for the throne, for the hall of judgment. This is a place where he would sit all day and judge the people. So not only did he build his home, not only did he build this house in Lebanon, now he builds in this area the Hall of Pillars. Now he's building the Hall of Judgment where he might judge, and it was also paneled with cedar from floor to ceiling. I'm not sure if cedar gives you wisdom, but after all this and how smart he was, maybe we need to panel our home. I don't know. Get some wisdom from him. It says, in the house where he dwelt had another court inside the hall of like wood workmanship. Solomon also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken as a wife. So now she gets a cedar chest or a huge, massive house paneled in cedar. Now, is cedar wood expensive? I don't know, Joe, you probably know anything more about cedar wood than anybody here. Absolutely. I mean, it's like 25 a board foot. I don't know. Something around there, it's expensive. Right. Yeah, get them in just anywhere. So if you know, a board foot is basically you're paying $25 for 12 inches. Now go panel your whole house. Gives you a perspective of what he just built. He built the hall. He built the home. He built the hall. He built the judgment hall. And then he made another house like this for one of his wives, for Pharaoh's daughter. He was very distracted. He was never done, always having projects, always doing things. And so it's interesting when you see all that is being done. And then it's interesting, as we go down through, after he made this judgment hall and he made this house for Pharaoh's daughter, verse 9 explains it a little bit more. All of these were of costly stones. If you underline your scriptures, underline how many times it says costly. These were all costly stones cut to size, trimmed with saws inside and out. Now, I want to explain these stones, where they were quarried, while they were soft, were able to be cut by stone with saws. It's once they were exposed to the elements and to the sun, they hardened like cement. So they were able to cut them with saws. Inside and out, from the foundation to the eaves, and also on the outside of the great court, the foundations was of costly stones, large stones, some 10 cubics, some 8 cubic. And above were costly stones, honed to size in cedar wood. And the great court was enclosed with three rows of honed stones and row of cedar beams. So were the inner courts of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the temple. And it goes back and continued to talk about the building. And this is just a small, small segment of what he built. I assume these are going on. One built right after another. It's like he never stopped. And so all of this being done, it's kind of interesting when you know or see that he built a lot, sparing no expense as he built, as we go down in the end of verse 12. And I found it very interesting when we do that, because when you go down, and we're going to pause for a moment in verse 12, because as I'd mentioned earlier, these are, I think, an ongoing understanding of what is yet to come. We saw in Hebrews 8 and 9, a copy, a shadow. And so the first coming of Christ, or the first coming of God, how did he come to this earth? He came as a babe in a manger. Scripture says he didn't even have a pillow to lay his head on. He came. He did not come with all his pomp and circumstance. He did not come with his kingship. He did not come with someone you would expect. And the problem with the Jews in that day, they expected their Messiah, their King of Kings, to come in with everything that they knew that a king would have. He come in not having anything. In fact, one of my greatest verses I love is in John, when Peter and Andrew go to him, realize who he is, and says, where do you reside, basically? Where do you go? Where do you lay your head? And Christ turns around and says to them, I think it's chapter 2, and says, come and see. That phrase has resonated in my head for a long time. Because whenever I want to find out or ask God, what are you doing? God, what's going on? God, how do I continue? God, how can I make the choices? And God never says, this is what you need to do. What God says is come and see. Basically, come with me and I'll show you. God just doesn't give us the answers to our prayers, does he? He just doesn't give us what we ask for. He says, come and see. We're gonna work through some of this. We're going to get to where you need to go. So the first time he came, again, the first tabernacle that Moses built, in fact, we know in Isaiah 53, he was not great to look upon. He was comely to look upon. On the outside, Christ, when he came into earth and was a man, he was not somebody of great tall stature. He was not somebody that they would all look at and think, wow, look at that. What a man. Because it says he was very comely to look upon in Isaiah 53. But inwardly, he was God. Tabernacle, do a study. When Moses built the tabernacle, the outside walls were made of cloth. The inner court started. It was made of the long veils and the woven soon as you got inside the Holy of Holies, that's when you saw the gold. That's when you saw what Isaiah 53 says about Christ coming. Inside, he was God. Outside, he was just the cloth. That first tabernacle. Solomon's temple, as we know, going back into understanding on his next, or his this temple being built, is basically, it's grand on the outside, grand on the inside, because Revelation says that Christ is going to be coming as a lion. He's coming back the second time as a lion, coming back as a mighty warrior, riding on the horse of white, going to settle it, finalize it at the end of the tribulation. So now he's coming back, and again, Solomon Temple is a copy, a shadow of the second coming of Christ. How he will come back, how he will be able to be grand on the outside and on the inside, just like Solomon built. And then we have yet to see what the new Jerusalem and the new heavens and the earth all look like, as John saw at the end of Revelations, and he saw coming out of heaven a new earth and a new Jerusalem. And so we've yet to see that one, but I guarantee it's going to be bigger than Solomon's temple. It's going to be grander than Solomon's temple, and we will not ever, ever, ever be able to put a price tag to it. I did a study on that one time, the walls of the new Jerusalem. And one of the gentlemen I studied with said, what he believed is, you know how the jewels and the gems were on the priest breastplate, the 12 stones? And he went and he did a study on all those stones and the clarity that some of them are a little transparent where you can see through but still see the color. He believed that that's what the walls of Jerusalem are going to be made of. And as the glory of God shines through, you will see the rainbow colors like you've never seen before. Wouldn't it be awesome? Man, you can't wait for that, huh? And Kim and I had to, we fortunately, we lucked out when the Aurora Lights was in our area here about a week before Mother's Day. We drove out to a hillside, and I knew looking north was open, looking west was open, and we got some phenomenal pictures of the Aurora Lights coming out of the sky. And we were standing there in a cemetery. Sorry. We were standing in a cemetery. I was out of the truck. Kim did eventually come out of the truck. Cemeteries aren't her favorite place. So, and we were standing there, and they started, we just seen them. And I got a picture when I did the panorama, going all the way around, and it circled us and went up straight like an umbrella. And it was like, and that's not even close to what heaven's going to be like. But it was phenomenal. That's off my bucket list. And I have one problem with that. My bucket list is getting smaller. I need to start adding something to my bucket list. But that was one of them. I was going to see the Aurora Lights. I wanted to go into Alaska and see them, but sorry. Brookfield Wood Products was the best I got. Anyway, but I can't imagine what heaven's going to be like. I can't imagine what the temple, what the Jerusalem is going to be like that God is still making. According to John 14, I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go to prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you will be also. He's still preparing. How do we know he's still preparing? Because we're still here. We're still here. Even after Solomon spent 7 years with 183,000 men making billions worth, billions of a building, it's nothing compared to what God's going to do. I want to tell you, it just blows my mind away to think of how these can be foreshadowing and how this can be going. So I think as Christ comes back in the second coming, this temple that he is building is a little bit of, could be a possibility of a shadow of what Christ will be coming as a lion, coming to conquer and coming to basically rule and reign. So, verse 13, he now, King Solomon, sent and brought Huram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre. His mother was from the Jews, his father was not. So, his heritage of the Jews came from his mother, and his father was a man of Tyre, a bronze worker. He was filled with the wisdom and understanding and the skill in working with all kinds of bronze work. So he came King Solomon. Now, So what? He was a craftsman. Who filled him? Who filled him? What's it say he filled him with? Wisdom, understanding, and skill. Who filled him? You think God had something to do with that? Turn back to Exodus 31. Exodus 31. Moses is building the tabernacle. And as Moses is building the tabernacle, he needs someone to build the artifacts or the things that are in the tabernacle. And verse 31 of Exodus, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, see, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Ur, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship. She's embarrassed, but that's right. Kim and I were talking. I said, you know, God has gifted you with creativity to decorate. Do it. God can make beauty out of anything. God, listen, it's a calling to be creative enough to put things together like that. It's a gift. It's a calling. And so when Moses was told by God, and the I have is all the Lord speaking to Moses in that text. He called him by name. He gave him a special calling of understanding, wisdom, and craftsmanship. He couldn't claim it. Look what I did. I went to school for 8 years, and look how smart I now am. Look at how all I'm doing. Listen, every one of us have a calling from God by name. He has gifted us. He has given us certain abilities. He has given us some to work with their hands, some to work with their minds. And it's all part of his plan. And he instills in us the wisdom, the understanding, and the skill to accomplish what he has called us to do. And that's a phenomenal life lesson. Because now all you need to know what the will of God is for your life, it is to exercise the gifts that he's given you. So take those gifts, take those things that you do well, that God has given you, and just do them for the glory of God. Some people, I can't tell you how many people in 30 years of ministry, I can't tell you how many people have said, I just don't know the will of God is what it is for my life. Well, what do you do every day? Unless you sit on the couch and play video games, I can't think that being the will of God. I just can't think that's a gift of God to play video games all day. But anyway, unless you do something like that, what you do have the ability to do, what you do to survive every day through this crazy world we live in, do it for the glory of God. If decorating is what you do, do it better than an unsaved person would do it. Why? Because you're giving glory to God. If you do anything, you name it, work with wood, tech, music, anything, teach, all of those things, you should do them better than the world. Why? Because God's filled you. He's given you wisdom and understanding and the gift to do it. That's what upsets me, just 0 to 60. And I don't get 0 to 60 very often. 0 to 60 is when Christians do a job just to get it done. Or they don't follow through with a job they said they would do. Listen, that's what the world does. You and I, we should have a working ethic that glorifies God. Why? Because he's filled us. He's given us the gift. He's given us the ability and understanding. Just like he did in Exodus to Bezalel. And then also now, back into 1 Kings, he did the same thing with this gentleman, Huram, from Tyre. He gifted him. And listen, sometimes we get tired doing what we do. You know, these people that, you know, I'm going to quit this job and I'm going to get a better job. Well, that's fine. That better job in about a year is going to be just like the one you just left. You're not going to want to get up and go to work every day. Very few people actually get to go do what they love to do every day. I'm one of those people. I tell everybody I come across, it's a spiritual gift Everybody else just gabs. I've been called to talk every day, all day. It's a gift from God. I glorify him the best I can in it, but we need to understand, listen, just do what God has gifted you to do. That is the will of God for your life. What the will of God is then to act upon it. Share it with everybody. Man, I'll tell you, this is pulling this out, these two, the gentleman, and then also this craftsman, very clearly, he was filled with wisdom, understanding, and the skill in the working with all kinds of bronze work. He was gifted by God. So now let's see what he makes. Go down in verse 15 of 1 Kings chapter 7, going back there. Now he's going to make bronze pillars. And he cast two pillars of bronze, each one 18 cubits high, and in the line of 12 cubic measured in circumference of each. Basically, the pole itself was about 27 feet, and with these the capitals or the caps on them added to, it would have went to roughly about 37 feet tall from the very top of the cap to the bottom of the cap. And so he made these pillars, and they're like 6 foot round in circumference. Now, if you study the archaeology of these, you'll find Josephus, the historian, said that they were hollow. So they weren't solid. Can you imagine lifting these up if they were solid? There's no way. They were hollow, about 3 inches thick, and they were hollow in two pillars. So what were they made for? It says in verse 16, then he made two caps or capitals of cast bronze, set them on the top of the pillars, and the height of the one cap was 5 cubits. The height of the other cap was 5 cubits. Made a lattice network with the reefs of chain work on the caps or the capitals, which were on the top of the pillars, 7 chains for one capital and 7 for the other capital. So he made the pillars and 2 rows of pomegranates from above the artwork all around the cover of the capitals that were on top, and thus he did for the other capital. Now again, the capital are on top, were in the shape of the pillars, were in the hall, were the shape of the lilies, 4 cubits. Capital on the two pillars had also pomegranates above by the convex surface, which were next to the network, and which were 200 such pomegranates in a row on each capitals all the way around. They set up the pillars by the vestibule in the temple. He set the pillars on the right and called its name Jachin, and he set the pillar on the left and called its name Boaz. What did these pillars hold? What were they holding up? Nothing. They were two pillars that were put in the entrance that had held up nothing. They were two simple pillars that he built. So, is there a significance to them? Just say yes, because it's in the Bible. Yes, there's a significance to them. So, when we look at this, first of all, it's kind of interesting. Because you guys can't turn around very well, but if you look, that thing that goes across where the clock is, you see them swirls and then it comes up into a lily and then it swirls on the other side? Those are the lilies of the Bible times. When you think of a lily, you don't think of that design. That's what the design is. That design with the two sides that curl up and around and come into this flower, that's the sign of a lily. That's a sign of royalty. And you may not have known that, but remember Barry Winger? He helped put us all together. He had those, and he gave those to us as a symbol of God's royalty around here. He is royalty. And so that was all. And even those stone or those wooden pillars holding up that fake balcony, they're all hand-carved out of Italy. They're hand... Kill me to paint them. But they're all hand-carved wood out of Italy. We have 6 or 7 of them in our church. And that were all gifts. Just so that we could honor God and his royalty. You see, that's what this man was doing. He was gifted with these things. These two pillars that stood, as explained. And again, when he says in this, the shape of lilies were 4 cubits... They put that design all the way around these pillars to show the royalty of God. The next thing we find is in verse 31 or 21, he set up the pillars by the vessels. He named them. Now, naming two pillars that are standing there holding up nothing, some may question his wisdom or his understanding. I'm not sure if any of you name any certain things that you own. We have named our plants in our house. If I'm lying, I'm dying. I'm telling you now. We take them to North Carolina in seat belts. They are our kids. They are our kids. We can't leave them here because if nobody's here to water them, they're going to die. We got to take them. I build them in the back seat. They go to North Carolina. Wow. Yeah. On that note, let's see what this means. It's amazing what we do. Anyway, the first name was Jachin. That is the Hebrew name, which means he shall establish. He being God. The second name that he chose, he set up the pillar on the left and called it Boaz. The Hebrew name meaning of the name Boaz is in him is our strength. These two pillars were placed at the entrance, and they would understand by those Hebrew names that God will establish, he is my strength. Now, interesting enough, you and I look at scriptures. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15, God set up, again, Deuteronomy and Leviticus and Deuteronomy were God setting up his way of doing things, right? And so in Deuteronomy, he stated that if someone sins and there is not another that witnesses, then you can't say it was a sin. But in the mouth of two or three witnesses, proof was made. Said the same thing in the New Testament, in Matthew. So these two pillars are witnesses that God's going to establish and he is our strength. They're witnesses. As they would go in, they would see this witness. And I'm telling you, it's amazing, isn't it? That we realize that these are, and I wish I would have thought of that. I would have wrote those names on the pillars up there. Nobody would have understood it. But anyway, we would have known. Because as we look at what he's saying, aren't we the pillars of God? Doesn't the New Testament call us the pillars? We are the rocks of standing on. Paul says he builds on the foundation of Christ, and we are to be the pillars. We are to be the witnesses of God. And so as this was built, as this temple was finished, or not finished, but as this portion of it is done, we ought to be pillars in our life that people see that he is a God who is going to establish. And he is the God of my strength. Because why? He has gifted us with understanding and wisdom. He has gifted us with a craft or abilities, way to get things accomplished. And as he has gifted us with those things, we need to exemplify them to a world. Because I tell you, there. And I know I've used this illustration before, but I went back and spoke in my high school years after I graduated, and their teachers were all standing backstage wanting to see if the Kevin Orndorff they knew was the same guy coming to preach. No way. No way was that the same guy. And I walked in and I just said, hey, grace of God, what are you going to do? And they, that surprised you, Kathy? Kathy's back to laughing. This shouldn't surprise anybody. But anyway, why? At that moment, what did I become? I became a pillar of God's grace. I became a pillar saying God establishes, God strengthens, God makes us who we could never be without him. That's who we need to be. God picks us up when we hurt. God picks us up when we fall down. God picks us up and creates us, and through our all bad or bad choices and whatever we've done, he picks us up, establishes us, and allows us to be something we never thought we'd be. So studying through all this and understanding some of this concept and pulling it into a perspective, it's just amazing to me. And again, I think Deuteronomy 19:15, as it brought out by mouth of two witnesses, and these pillars are witnessing for our God how great he is. So you and I, go be a pillar. Go be a testimony for God, because I think think a lot of us, listen, I realize, you know, the older we get, and I'm not making fun, the older we get, the harder it is. I mean, it's just, it's life. And it's hard to get up and do some of the things we used to do. It's hard to be able to go after it as fast and as furious as we used to. And that's just life. But there's still something you can do. You still have a bit, as long as you're breathing, you still got an ability to be able to go do something that God has given you the ability to do. Call somebody up. Encourage them with a card. Send them a card. Bake a plate of cookies. Do what God has given you the ability to do. Play it forward to the people that you know need it. And you will become a pillar for the cause of Christ. And that's exactly what we need to be. Let's pray. God, we thank you. We thank you for the study tonight. And I pray as we continue to just understand it and apply it to our lives, that we do so in a way that really just encourages us. God, we don't know what strength we're going to need tomorrow. We don't know what wisdom we're going to need and understanding we're going to need. But you've given it to us already. And God, you have prepared everything we need, that when we wake up in the morning, it's there. And God, I just pray as we look into a new day tomorrow, that we look into it with a joy. We look into it with an excitement to see what opportunities we may have. And God, we just thank you for how you care for us and how you blessed us. And God, even through the understanding of some of the Old Testament ways, all along, you have and are preparing for that final day, when we will be with you forever and ever. And God, we just thank you for that. We pray in your Son's name. Amen. Thank you.